through bark and blasted wood, and back into the smoking wreck of the Heart Grove. I came out on the mound, my dress soaked green with sap, the shattered tree behind me. The light of the summoning still blazed across the water, and the last shallow remnants of the pool shone beneath it like a full moon just up over the horizon, so bright it hurt to look at it. Sarkon was on the other side of the pool, on his knees. His mouth was wet, his hand dripping, the only parts of him not blackened with soot and dirt and smoke. He'd cupped water to his mouth. He'd drunk from the spindle, water and power both, to gather enough strength to cast the summoning alone. But now, the Wood Queen was standing over him, with her long fingers wrapped choking around his neck. Silver bark was climbing up from the bank over his knees and his legs as he struggled to pry her grip from around his throat. She let him go and whirled with a cry of protest at my escape. Too late. With a long groaning above me, the great broken branch of the heart tree cracked away from the trunk and finally fell, thundering, leaving a gaping, hollow wound. I stepped down from the mound to meet her on the wet stones as she came furious towards me.
Agnieszka!
Sarkon shouted hoarsely, reaching an arm out, straggling, half-rooted in the earth. But even as she reached me, the Wood Queen slowed and halted. The summoning light illuminated her from behind. The terrible corruption in her, the sour black cloud of long despair. But it shone on me also, on me and through me, and I knew that in my face she saw someone else looking out at her. I could see in her where she'd gone from the grove, how she'd hunted them down, all the people of the tower, wizards and farmers and woodcutters all alike, how she'd planted one corrupt heart tree after another in the roots of her own misery, and fed that misery onward. Mingled with my horror, I felt Linaya's pity moving in me, deep and slow. Pity and sorrow and regret. The Wood Queen saw it too, and it held her still before me, trembling.
I stopped them, she said,
her voice the scrape of a branch against a window pane at night, when you imagine some dark thing is outside the house, scratching to get in.
I had to stop them.
She wasn't speaking to me. Her eyes were looking past me, deep towards her sister's face.
They burned the trees, she said,
pleading for understanding from someone long gone.
They cut them down. They will always cut them down. They come and go like seasons. The winter that gives no thought to the spring.
Her sister didn't have a voice to speak with anymore. But the sap of the heart tree clung to my skin, and its roots went deep beneath my feet. We're meant to go, I said softly, answering for both of us. We're not meant to stay forever. The Wood Queen finally looked at me then, instead of through me.
I couldn't go, she said,
and I knew she'd tried. She'd killed the Tower Lord and his soldiers. She'd planted all the fields with new trees, and she'd come here, with her hands bloody, to sleep with her people at last. But she hadn't been able to take root. She'd remembered the wrong things, and forgotten too much. She'd remembered how to kill, and how to hate, and she'd forgotten how to grow. All she'd been able to do in the end was lie down beside her sister. Not quite dreaming, not quite dead. I reached out, and from the one low-hanging bough of the broken tree, I took the single waiting fruit, glowing and golden. I held it out to her. I'll help you, I told her. If you want to save her, you can. She looked up at the shattered, dying tree. Mud tears were leaking from her eyes, thick brown rivulets sliding over her cheeks. Dirt and ash and water mingled. She put her hand slowly up to take the fruit from me. Her long, gnarled, twiggy fingers, curling carefully around it, gently, they brushed against mine, and we looked at one another. For a moment, through the winding smoke between us, I might have been the daughter she'd hoped for, the child halfway between the tower people and her own. She might have been my teacher and my guide, like Yaga's book, showing me the way. We might never have been enemies at all. I bent down, and in one curled-up leaf, I drew a little water for her, the last clear water left in the pool. We stepped together up onto the mound. She lifted the fruit to her mouth and bit, juices running down her chin in pale golden dripping lines. She shut her eyes and stood there. I put my hand on her, felt hate and agony like a strangler vine tangled deep through her. I put my other hand on the sister tree, though, and reached for the deep well in her. The stillness and the calm. Being struck by lightning hadn't changed her. The stillness would remain, even when the whole tree had fallen, even while the years crumbled it back into the earth. The wood queen leaned against the tree's gaping wound and put her arms around the blackened trunk. I gave her the last drops of the pool's water, tipping them into her mouth, and then I touched her skin and said softly, very simply, Vanalem. And she was changing. The last remnants of her white gown blew away, and the charred surface of her scorched skin peeled off in huge black flakes, fresh new bark whirling up from the ground around her like a white silver skirt, meeting and merging into the old tree's broken trunk. She opened her eyes one last time and looked at me with sudden relief, and then she was gone. She was growing, her feet plunging new roots over the old. I backed away, and when her roots had sunk deep into the earth, I turned and ran to Sarkhan through the mud of the emptied pool. The bark had stopped climbing up over him. Together, we broke him the rest of the way loose, peeling it away from his skin, until his legs came free. I pulled him up from the stump and we sat together, sagged together, on the bank of the stream. I was too spent to think of anything. He was scowling down at his own hands, almost resentfully. Abruptly he lurched forward and leaned over the stream bed and dug into the soft wet earth. I watched him blankly for a while, and then I realized he was trying to restore the course of the stream. I pulled myself up and reached in to help. I could feel it as soon as I started, the same feeling he hadn't wanted to have, the sure sense that this was the right thing to do. The river wanted to run this way, wanted to feed into the pool. It only took moving a few handfuls of dirt, and then the stream was running over our fingers, clearing the rest of the bed for itself. The pool began to fill once more. We sat back again, wearily. Next to me, he was trying to get the dirt and water off his hands, wiping them on the corner of his ruined shirt, on the grass, on his trousers, mostly just spreading the mud around. Black half-circles were crusted deep under the fingernails. He finally heaved an exasperated noise and let his hands fall into his lap. He was too tired to use magic. I leaned against his side, his irritation oddly comforting. After a moment, he grudgingly put his arm around me. The deep quiet was already settling back upon the grove, as if all the fire and rage we'd brought could make only a brief interruption in its peace. The ash had sunk into the muddy bottom of the pool and been swallowed up. The trees were letting their scorched leaves fall into the water, and moss crept over the torn bare patches of earth, new blades of grass unfurling. At the head of the pool, the new hard tree tangled with the old one, bracing it up, sealing over the jagged scar. They were putting out Small white flowers, like stars. Chapter 32. I fell asleep in the grove, empty-headed and spent. I didn't notice Sarkhan lifting me in his arms or taking me back to the tower. I roused only long enough to mutter a complaint to him after the unpleasant stomach twist of his jumping spell, and then I sank down again. When I woke up tucked under a blanket in my narrow bed, in my narrow room, I kicked the blanket off my legs and got up without thinking about clothes. There was a rip all the way across the valley painting, where a jagged chip of rock had torn it. The canvas hung down in flaps, all the magic gone out of it. I went out into the hallway, picking my way over bits of broken stone and cannonballs littering the floor and rubbing at my greedy eyes. When I came down the stairs, I found Sarkhan packing to leave. "Someone has to clear out the corruption from the capital before it spreads any farther," he said. "Alyosha will be a long time recovering, and the court will have to return south by the end of the summer." He was in riding clothes and boots of red-dyed leather, tooled in silver. I was still a shambling mess of soot and mud, ragged enough to be a ghost, but too mucky. He barely looked me in the face, stuffing flasks and vials into a padded case, another sack full of books already waiting on the laboratory table between us. The floor slanted askew beneath our feet. The walls gaped here and there where the cannonballs had struck or stones had fallen. And the summer warm wind whistled cheerfully between the cracks and blew papers and powders all over the floor, leaving faint smeared drifts of red and blue on the stone. "I've propped the tower up for the moment," he added, as he laid down a corked, well-sealed flask of violet smoke. "I'll take the fireheart with me. You might start the repairs in the..." "I won't be here," I said, cutting him off. "I'm going back to the wood."
"Don't be absurd," he said. "Do you think the death of a witch turns all her works to dust, or that her change of heart can repair them all at once? The wood is still full of monstrosities and corruption, and will be for a long time to come."
He wasn't wrong. And the wood queen wasn't dead anyway. She was only dreaming. But he wasn't going for the sake of corruption or the kingdom. His tower was broken. He'd drunk spindle water, and he'd held my hand. So now, he was going to run away as quick as he could and find himself some new stone walls to hide behind. He'd keep himself locked away for 10 years this time, until he weathered his own roots and didn't feel the lack of them anymore. "It won't get any less full of them for my sitting in a heap of stones," I said. I turned and left him with his bottles and his books. Above my head, the wood was aflame with red and gold and orange, but a few confused spring flowers in white poked up through the forest floor. A last wave of summer heat had struck this week, just at harvest time. In the fields, the threshers labored under fierce sun, but it was cooler here, in the dim light beneath the heavy canopy, alongside the running gurgle of the spindle. I walked barefoot, on crackling fallen leaves, with my basket full of golden fruit, and stopped at the curving in the river. A walker was crouched by the water, putting its stick head down to drink. It saw me and held still, wary, but it didn't run away. I held out one of the fruits from my basket. The walker crept towards me little by little on its stiff legs. It stopped, just out of arm's reach. I didn't move. Finally, it stretched out two forelegs and took the fruit and ate it, turning it around and around in its hands, nibbling until it had cleaned it down to the seed. Afterwards, it looked at me, and then, tentatively, took a few steps into the forest. I nodded. The walker led me a long way into the forest, into the trees. At last, it held aside a heavy mat of vines from what looked like a sheer stone cliff face, and showed me a narrow cut in the rock, a thick, sweet, rotten stench rolling out. We climbed through the passage into the sheltered narrow vale. At one end stood an old, twisted heart tree, gray with corruption, the trunk bulging unnaturally. Its boughs hung forward over the grass of the vale, so laden with fruit that the tips brushed the ground. The walkers stood anxiously aside. They'd learned that I would cleanse the sickened heart trees if I could, and a few of them had even begun to help me. They had a gardener's instinct, it seemed to me, now that they were free of the Wood Queen's driving rage, or maybe they only liked the uncorrupted fruit better. There were still nightmare things in the wood, nursing too much rage of their own. They mostly avoided me, but now and then I stumbled over the torn and spoiled body of a rabbit or a squirrel, killed, as far as I could see, just for cruelty. And sometimes one of the walkers who had helped me would reappear torn and limping, a limb snapped off as by mantis jaws, or its side scored deeply by claws. Once in a dim part of the wood, I fell into a pit trap cleverly covered over with leaves and moss to blend into the forest floor, and full of broken sticks and a hideous glistening ooze that clung and burned my skin until I went to the grove and washed it off in the pool. I still had a slow healing scab on my leg where one of the sticks had cut me. It might have been just an ordinary animal's trap set for prey. But I didn't think so. I thought it had been meant for me. I hadn't let it stop my work. Now I ducked under the branches and went to the heart tree's trunk with my jug. I poured a drink of spindle water over its roots, but I knew even as I began that there wasn't much hope for this one. There were too many souls caught inside, twisting the tree in every direction, and they had been there too long. There wasn't enough left of them to bring out, and it would be almost impossible to calm and ease them all together, to slip them into dreaming. I stood with my hands on the bark for a long time, trying to reach them, but even the ones I found had been lost so long they had forgotten their names. They lay without walking in shadowed, dim places, blank-eyed and exhausted. Their faces had half lost their shape. I had to let go at last and step away, shivering and chilled through, though the hot sun came down through the leaves. The misery clung to my skin, wanting to climb inside. I ducked back out from beneath the tree's heavy branches and sat down in a patch of open sunlight at the other end of the vale. I took a drink from my jug, resting my forehead against the beaded wet side. Two more walkers had come creeping through the passageway to join the first. They were sitting in a row, their long heads all bent intently towards my basket. I fed each of them a clean fruit, and when I started working, they helped me. Together, we heaped dry kindling against the trunk and dug a broad circle of dirt around the limits of the hard tree's branches. I stood up and arched my tired back when we were done stretching. Then I rubbed my hands with dirt. I went back to the heart tree and put my hands back on its sides. But this time, I didn't try to speak with the trapped souls. "Kisara," I said, and drew the water out. I worked gently, slowly. The water beaded up in fat droplets on the bark and trickled slowly down in thin wet rivulets to sink into the ground. The sun moved onward overhead, coming ever more strongly through the leaves as they curled up and went dry. It was dipping out of sight by the time I finished, my forehead sticky with sweat and my hands covered with sap. The ground beneath my feet was soft and damp, and the tree had gone pale as bone, its branches making a noise like rattling sticks in the wind. The fruit had all withered on the boughs. I stood clear and kindled it with a word. Then I sat heavily and wiped my hands on the grass as well as I could and pulled my knees up to my chest. The walkers folded their legs neatly and sat around me. The tree didn't thrash or shriek, already more than half gone. It went up quickly and burnt without much smoke. Flakes of ash fell on the damp ground and melted into it like early snowflakes. They landed on my bare arms sometimes, not big enough to burn, just tiny sparks. I didn't back away. We were the only mourners the tree and its dreamers had left. I fell asleep at some point while the bonfire went on, tired from my work. When I woke in the morning, the tree was burned out, a black stump that crumbled easily into ash. The walkers raked the ash evenly around the clearing with their many-fingered hands, leaving a small mound at the center where the old tree had stood. I planted a fruit from my basket beneath it. I had a vial of growing potion that I'd brewed up out of river water and the seeds of hard trees. I sprinkled a few drops over the mound and sang encouragement to the fruit until a silver sapling poked its head out and climbed up to 3 years' height. The new tree didn't have a dream of its own, but it carried on the quiet dream of the grove tree the fruit had come from, instead of tormented nightmares. The walkers would be able to eat the fruit when it came. I left them tending it, busily putting up a shade of tall branches to keep its fresh new leaves from crisping in the hot sun, and went away through the stones back out into the wood. The ground was full of ripened nuts and tangles of brambleberries, but I didn't gather while I walked. It would be a long time yet before it would be safe to eat any fruit from outside the grove. There was too much sorrow under the boughs, too many of the tormented heart trees still anchoring the forest. I'd brought out a handful of people from a heart tree in Zatochik, and another handful from the Rossian side. But those had been people taken only very lately. The heart trees took everything, flesh and bone, and not just dreams. Marek's hope had always been the false one, I'd discovered. Anyone who'd been caught inside for more than a week or two was too much a part of the tree to be brought out again. I had been able to ease some of those and help them slide into the long, deep dream. A few of them had even found their way into dreaming by themselves, once the Wood Queen had slipped away, her animating rage gone. But that left hundreds of heart trees still standing, many of them in dark and secret places of the wood. Drawing the water out of them and giving them to the fire was the gentlest way I'd found to set them free. It still felt like killing someone every time, although I knew it was better than leaving them trapped and lingering. The great sorrow of it stayed with me afterwards. This morning, a clanging bell surprised me out of my weary fog, and I pushed aside a bush to find a yellow cow staring back at me, chewing grass meditatively. I was near the border on the Rossian side, I realized. "You'd better go back home," I told the cow. "I know it's hot, but you're too likely to eat the wrong thing in here." A girl's voice was calling her in the distance, and after a moment, she came through the bushes and stopped when she saw me, 9 years old or so. "Does she run away into the forest a lot?" I asked her, stumbling a little over my Rossian. "Our meadow is too small," the girl said, looking up at me with clear blue eyes. "But I always find her." I looked down at her and knew she was telling the truth. There was a strand of silver bright inside her, magic running close to the surface. "Don't let her go too deep," I said. "And when you get older, come and find me. I live on the other side of the wood." "Are you Baba Yaga?" she asked interestedly. "No," I said, "but you might call her a friend of mine." Now I had woken up enough to know where I was. I turned back westward right away. The Rossians had sent soldiers to patrol the borders of the wood on their side, and I didn't want to distress them. They were still uneasy about me popping out on their side now and then, even after I'd sent back some of their lost villagers, and I couldn't really blame them. All the songs streaming out of Polnia were wrong about me in different and alarming ways. and I suspected that the bards weren't bringing the most outrageous ones to my side of the valley at all. A man had been booed out of Alshanka Tavern a few weeks ago, I'd heard, for trying to sing one where I'd turned into a wolf beast and eaten up the king. But my step was lighter anyway. Meeting the little girl and her cow had lifted some of the gray weight from my shoulders. I sang Yaga's walking song and hurried away, back towards home. I was hungry, so I ate a fruit from my basket as I walked. I could taste the forest in it, the running magic of the spindle, caught in roots and branches and fruit, infused with sunlight to become sweet juice on my tongue. There was an invitation in it too, and maybe one day I would want to accept. One day, when I was tired and ready to dream a long dream of my own. But for now, it was only a door standing open on a hill in the distance, a friend waving to me from afar, and the grove's deep sense of peace. Kasha had written me from Gidna. The children were doing as well as could be hoped. Stashik was still very quiet, but he had stood up and spoken to the Magnati when they had been summoned to vote, well enough to persuade them to crown him with his grandfather as his regent. He'd also agreed to be betrothed to the Archduke of Varsha's daughter, a girl of 9, who had evidently impressed him a great deal by being able to spit across a garden plot. I was a little dubious about this as a foundation for marriage, but I suppose it wasn't much worse than marrying her because her father might have stirred up rebellion otherwise. There had been a tourney to celebrate Stashik's coronation, and he'd asked Kasha to be his champion, much to his grandmother's dismay. It had turned out halfway for the best, because the Roshians sent a party of knights, and after Kasha knocked them all down, it made them wary about invading us in revenge for the battle at the Ridva. Enough soldiers had escaped the siege of the tower to carry tales of the invulnerable golden warrior queen, slaughtering and unstoppable, and people had mixed her up with Kasha. So Rosia had grudgingly accepted Stashik's request for a renewed truce, and our summer had ended in a fragile peace with time for both sides to mend. Stashik had also used Kasha's triumph to name her captain of his guard. Now she was learning how to fight with a sword properly, so she didn't knock into the other knights and tumble them over accidentally while they were all drilling together. 2 lords and an archduke had asked her to marry them, and so, she wrote to me in outrage, "Hetsolia, can you imagine? I told him I thought he was a lunatic, and he said he would live in hope." Alyosha laughed for 10 minutes without stopping, except to cough when I told her. And then she said he'd done it knowing I'd say no, just to demonstrate to the court that he's loyal to Stashik now. I said I wouldn't go bragging of someone asking me to marry them. And she said, just watch. He'd spread it around himself. Sure enough, half a dozen people asked me about it the next week. I almost wanted to go and tell him I'd have him after all, just to see him squirm. But I was too afraid he'd decide to go through with it for some reason or another, and he'd find some way not to let me out. Alyosha's better every day, and the children are doing well too. They go sea bathing together every morning. I come along and sit on the beach, but I can't swim anymore. I just sink straight to the bottom, and the salt water feels all wrong on my skin, even if I just put my feet into it. Send me another jug of river water, please. I'm always a little thirsty here, and it's good for the children, too. They never have the nightmares about the tower if I let them have a sip of it before they sleep. I'll come for a real visit this winter, if you think it's safe for the children. I thought they'd never want to come back, but Marisha asked if she could come and play at Natalia's house again. I miss you. I took one last blurred hop step to come to the spindle, and the clearing where my own little tree cottage stood, coaxed out of the side of an old drowsy oak. On one side of my doorway, The oak's roots made a big hollow that I had lined with grass. I tried to keep it full of grove fruit for the walkers to take. It was emptier than when I'd left. And on the other side of my doorway, someone had filled my wood box. I put the rest of my gathered fruit into the hollow and went inside for a moment. The house didn't need tidying. The floor was soft moss, and the grass coverlet turned itself back over the bed without my help after I climbed out in the mornings. I did need tidying, badly. But I'd wasted too much time wandering gray and tired this morning. The sun was climbing past noon, and I didn't want to be late. I only picked up my reply for Kasia and a corked jug of spindle water and put them in my basket so I could give them to Danka to post for me. I went back out onto the riverbank and took three more big steps going west to come out of the wood at last. I crossed the spindle at Zatochik Bridge in the shade of the tall young hard tree growing there. The wood queen had made a final furious push at the same time as Sarkan and I were floating down the river to find her, and the trees had half swallowed Zatochik before we stopped her. People fleeing the village met me on the road as I walked away from the tower. I ran the rest of the way and found a handful of desperate defenders about to chop down the newly planted hard tree. They'd stayed behind to buy time for their families to escape, but they'd done it expecting to be taken, corrupted. They were wild-eyed and terrified even in their courage. I don't think they would have listened to me if it hadn't been for my ragged flapping clothes, my hair in snarls and blackened with soot, and my feet bare in the road. I couldn't easily have been anything but a witch. Even then, they weren't quite sure whether to believe me when I told them the wood had been defeated, defeated for good. None of us had imagined such a thing ever happening. But they'd seen the mantises and the walkers go fleeing suddenly back into the wood, and they were all very tired by then. In the end, they stood back and let me work. The tree hadn't been even a day old. The walkers had bound the village headman and his three sons into it to make it grow. I was able to bring the brothers out, but their father refused. A hot coal of pain had been burning slowly in his belly for a year. "I can help you," I'd offered, but the old man shook his head, his eyes half dreaming already, smiling, and the hard knobs of his bones and body, trapped beneath the bark, melted away suddenly beneath my hands. The crooked hard tree sighed and straightened up. It dropped all its poisonous blooms at once. New flowers budded on the branches instead. We all stood together for a moment under the silver branches, breathing in their faint fragrance, nothing like the overwhelming rotten sweetness of the corrupt flowers. Then the defenders noticed what they were doing, shifted nervously, and backed away. They were as afraid to accept the heart tree's peace as Sarkan and I had been in the grove. None of us knew how to imagine something that came from the wood and wasn't evil and full of hate. The headman's sons looked at me helplessly. "Can you bring him out too?" the eldest asked. I had to tell them that there wasn't anything to bring him out of anymore, that the tree was him. I was too tired to explain very well, but anyway, it wasn't something people could easily understand, even people from the valley. The son stood in baffled silence, confused whether to grieve or not. "He missed mother," the elder said finally, and they all nodded. None of the villagers felt easy about having a hard tree growing on their bridge, but they trusted me enough at least that they'd left it standing. It had grown well since then. Its roots were already twining themselves enthusiastically with the logs of the bridge, promising to take it over. It was laden with fruit and birds and squirrels. Not many people were ready to eat a hard tree's fruit yet, but the animals trusted their noses. I trusted mine too. I picked a dozen more for my basket and went on, singing my way down the dusty long road to Dvernik. Little Anton was out with his family's flock, lazing on his back in the grass. He jumped up when I lurched into his field, a little nervously, but mostly everyone had gotten used to my appearing now and then. I might have been shy of going home at first, after everything that had happened. But I'd been so tired after that terrible day, tired and lonely and angry and sad all at once, the Wood Queen's sorrow and my own all tangled up. After I finally finished clearing out Zatochik, almost without thinking, my weary feet turned and took me home. My mother took one look at me in the doorway and didn't say anything, just put me to bed. She sat beside me and stroked my hair, singing until I fell asleep. Everyone was jumpy around me the next day when I came out to the village green to talk to Danka and tell her a little of what had happened, and to look in on Wensa and on Jerzy and Christina. But I was still tired and in no mood to be considerate, so I just ignored the twitching, and after a while of my not setting anything on fire or turning into a beast, it stopped. I learned from the lesson to make people get used to me. Now I made a point of stopping into all the villages regularly, a different one each Saturday. Sarkan hadn't come back. I didn't know if he'd ever come back. I heard fourth or fifth hand that he was still in the capital, setting things right, but he hadn't written. Well, we'd never needed a lord to settle quarrels for us. The headmen and women could do that, and the wood wasn't the same kind of danger as before. But there were some things a village needed a wizard for, if they could get one. So I went around to all of them and put a spell on the beacon fires. And now, if they lit them, a matching candle in my cottage lit up to tell me where I was wanted. But today I wasn't here to work. I waved to Anton and tramped on into the village. The heaped harvest tables were out on the green, dressed in white cloth, with the square in the middle for dancing. My mother was there with Wensa's two oldest daughters, putting out trays full of stewed mushrooms. I ran and kissed her, and she put her hands on my cheeks and smoothed my tangled hair back, smiling with her whole face. "Look at you," she said, picking a long silver twig out of my hair and some dried brown leaves. "And you might as well be wearing boots. I should tell you to go wash up and sit quietly in the corner." My bare legs were thick with dust to my knees. But she was laughing, joyful, and my father was driving the wagon cart in with a load for the evening bonfire. "I'll clean up before it's time to eat," I said, stealing a mushroom, and went to go sit with Wensa in the front room of her house. She was better, but still spent most of her time sitting in the chair by the window, only sewing a little. Kasia had written to her too, but a stiff, stilted letter. I had read it to her and softened it a little where I could. Wensa listened to it in silence. I think there was a secret guilt in her to match Kasia's secret resentment, a mother who had resigned herself to an unnecessary fate. That would be a long time healing, too, if it ever did. She did let me persuade her to come to the green with me, and I saw her settled at the tables with her daughters. There wasn't a pavilion this year. It was only our own small village festival. The big festival was in Alshanka, as it was every year, without the choosing, as it would be every year from now on. We were all too hot eating in the sun, an odd sensation for harvest time, until it finally sank low. I didn't care. I ate a big bowl of sour zurek with slices of boiled eggs floating, and a plateful of stewed cabbage and sausage, and then four blini full of sour cherries. Then we all sat around in the sun, groaning how good the food had been and how we'd all eaten too much, while the small children ran around wildly in the green until little by little they lay down under the trees and fell asleep. Ludek brought out his suka and put it across his knees and began playing, quietly at first. As more of the children drowsed off, more instruments came out and began joining in. People clapping and singing as the mood took them. And we opened the beer casks and passed around the cold jug of vodka brought up from Danka's cellar. I danced with Kasha's brothers and mine, and after that, with a handful of other boys I knew a little. I think they were off to one side, daring one another to ask me, but I didn't care. They were a little nervous that I might lob fire at their heads, but in the same way, I had been nervous to go creeping across old Hanka's yard at twilight to steal the big sweet red apples from her tree, the best ones for eating. We were all happy, all together, and I could recognize the song of the river running through the ground beneath our feet, the song we really danced to. I sat down in a breathless heap in front of my mother's chair. My hair tumbled loose around my shoulders again, and she gave a sigh and put it in her lap to braid it back up. My basket was at her feet, and I took another of the tree fruits to eat, golden and bursting with juice. I was licking my fingers and half lost in the bonfire when Danka stood up abruptly from the long bench corner to ours. She put down her cup and said loudly, enough to make everyone pay attention, "My lord." Sarkan was standing at the opening of the circle, one hand perched on the table nearest him, firelight leaping to pick out his silver rings and fine silver buttons and the winding silver embroidery along the edges of his blue coat. A dragon, whose head began at his collar and ran all along the borders of the coat, until the tail came back up to the collar on the other side. The lace cuffs of his shirt spilled past the sleeves, and his boots were so brightly polished the fire shone in them. He looked grander than the king's ballroom, and perfectly improbable. All of us were staring at him, me included. His mouth thinned with what I would have called displeasure once, and now named prickly mortification. I climbed to my feet and went to him, licking my thumb clean. He darted a look at the uncovered basket behind me, saw what I was eating, and glared at me. "That's appalling," he said. "They're wonderful," I said. "They're all coming ripe." "All the better to turn you into a tree," he said. "I don't want to be a tree yet," I said. Happiness was bubbling up through me, a bright stream laughing. "He'd come back." "When did you arrive?"
"This afternoon," he said stiffly. "I came to receive the taxes, of course."
"Of course," I said. I was sure he'd even gone to Alshanka for the tribute first, just so he could pretend that was the truth for a little bit longer. But I couldn't really bring myself to pretend with him. Not even long enough for him to get used to the idea. My mouth was already turning up at the corners without my willing it to. He flushed and looked away. But that wasn't any better for him, since everyone else was watching us with enormous interest, too drunk on beer and dancing to be polite. He looked back at me instead, and scowled at my smile.
"Come and meet my mother," I said. I reached out and took his hand.
This is Julia Emmelin. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Uprooted by Naomi Novik. This program was directed by Danny Campbell. Executive producer, Juliana Wilson. Text copyright 2015 by Tamarer LLC. Production copyright 2015, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.